Thank you very much, everyone, for coming along to this talk. I hope you'll find it entertaining and possibly even slightly controversial. I have no idea. So I'm speaking to you here from leafy Islington, where it is sweltering and humid. So hopefully I'll remain conscious long enough to deliver the following text. This talk looks at how the way we think is a form of technology. Starting with mundane objects, like a bicycle, it looks at how the ideas behind inventions are not the outcomes of lone geniuses and inspiration, but are connected to social relations and practices. It discounts the idea that history is driven by simple technological changes and looks back to the age of conquest to show how it was how technology was applied rather than the possession of technology itself that was behind the establishment of the European empires. It concludes by looking at the implications for socialism and how a future society might use technology. Human beings make history, but not in conditions of their own choosing. That is the cornerstone of Karl Marx's method of historical materialism as a way of looking at and understanding human societies. So we're going to be looking at how humans, rather than things, produce the story of the world as we know it. The idea for my talk comes from a visit to the Flight Gallery at the Science Museum many years ago now, where there is a board explaining the development of the technology of flying. I remember being struck by something it said, and here I have to quote from memory, to the effect that technology for heavier-than-air flight existed in Roman times, but that it was the obsession with flapping that prevented the correct method from being discovered sooner. This is a superficially attractive idea, but the fact is, I'm going to argue, that a key technological requirement was actually missing. So let's take a different example, the technology of the bicycle, which has existed, in essence, since the invention of the wheel, where there is no flap confusion. In its minimal form, two wheels and a frame, it could have been invented at any time in human history. We know, for instance, the classical world possessed driving wheels and crankshafts. For example, they had water-powered saws to cut marble slabs for them. While the linked chain, derailleur gear, and saddle suspension do require advanced precision engineering, these advances on the basic form of the bike are not essential to it. So we are entitled to ask why it was that a form of technology available throughout human history didn't emerge until Baron Carl von Drais developed his Draisin, or velocipede machine, as late as 1817. It could be argued that it was the spirit of the age, or the German national genius. It could equally be ascribed to providence, or the direct influence of God's will. All of these arguments have been put forward to account for the emergence of new technologies and their consequences in history. It could be argued, equally argued, that it was the random genius of the individual, Carl von Drais. These arguments are made, usually implicitly more than explicitly, and they do matter. For example, one account of the history of imperialism and colonialism has been what we could call the War of the Worlds theory of history. The ineluctable rise of European powers because they alone had the technology and thus the natural superiority to conquer the world. Sometimes that ability is ascribed to providence, that the Europeans had a God-given right to conquer because they had the tech or God gave them the technology. It also often takes the form of racism, that Europeans, or whites, had a native genius that surpassed and justified the conquest of inferior, quotes, races of the world. This account is too simplistic and definitely self-serving, though. Wells's novel of that title was a speech of imperial anxiety. What if someone else comes along with technology greater than the mightiest military power then on Earth? Notably, its end is itself providential, with the Martians being laid low by terrestrial bacteria, and also slightly nativist, inasmuch as they don't belong here, therefore they're sent away. But the anxiety has lived on. Today often takes the form of the Hollywood fear of machines themselves taking over, freed from the weakness of biology. A great many of the recent Marvel superhero movies were motivated by the fear of the domination of technology, and very frequently, and specifically, of other people getting hands on technology possessed by the all-American heroes. There's a very anxiety about the spread of technology. So let's turn then to the actual concrete example in history of the conquest by the Spanish over the Inca Empire in Peru. The story is quite familiar. Most of us learned it as children or in some form. Pizarro and his small band of men turned up in Peru, and because they had guns, steel swords, and armor and horses, they easily overcame the might of an empire that stretched the length of the Andes to become the undisputed rulers over 10 million people. 200 men defeated an army of 50,000, so it must be obvious that the technology was decisive. I would agree to an extent, but it wasn't the guns or steel or horses that were decisive. The military ideology of the conquistadors, that is, their way of thinking, rather than the specific ideas in themselves. And there was also a great deal of fatuity about it, as we'll see. The Spanish had already conquered over many American tribes on the way to Peru, including over the Aztecs. They had a well-developed idea of their own superiority, backed up with a belief that they were spreading the word of God, so they demanded subservience to their king and to God simultaneously. Up until Pizarro's arrival in Peru, his expedition had had not much luck, but they had found signs of immense wealth available among the American peoples, and they were very determined to get their hands on it. The Incas themselves were War of the World-style conquerors. Civilization in their region was ancient, highly developed towards existence in high mountainous terrains and varied conditions, and their adaptations to their conditions were ingenious. But they had never invented the wheel, perhaps because of a lack of flat land to roll anything on. Their army was highly organized. They had roads, storehouses, and advanced systems of communication, including a form of writing using pieces of string. And this allowed them to rule over their newly acquired and vast empire. Inca warfare was highly ritualized. It aligned closely with diplomacy. 80 years prior to the arrival of the conquistadors, the Inca had expanded their empire through a mix of diplomacy and slaughter. If an enemy would not succumb, the Inca would gather an army and wait until they had twice the number or so of their opponent, and then attack with overwhelming numbers. The weapons were simple, spears and clubs, and they wore little or no armour. The attack could be preceded by days of chanting and hurling insults between the two sides. That is, their warfare was in part symbolic, trying to force capitulation without combat, followed by decisive action against inferior forces. It was a type of demonstration of which chief had the most followers. And then it wasn't so much about fighting the battle as about active murder of a force that can't resist. And their idea of warfare suffused throughout their culture, and farming was conceived of, as according to records and histories I've read, as a form of warfare for them, with the plough attacking the earth. In battle, demonstrating who had the greater numbers was the important part of the battle. Subtlety, manoeuvre and strategy were not components, because the Inca were used to winning with force of numbers alone. It was warfare based on who had the most humans on their side. And I think that's the significant point here. Pizarro came from a European school of warfare, which we can see through the popularity at the time of chess, relied on rapid strikes, bold professional soldiers winning closely matched encounters, strategy and thinking things through. And thus, his decision, and I think this is where the chess metaphor I think is particularly apt, was to seize the great Inca himself and checkmate his opponents in a rapid movement display. The great Inca, Atahualpa, came to negotiate with Pizarro, and with only a relatively small guard, a few thousand strong, leaving his main force outside the city. Pizarro was trapped, and he knew that taking the great Inca was his only hope. Necessity drove his actions as much as desire. They ambushed the Inca's retinue. And indeed, the Incas were surprised by the gunfire and the horses, because they'd never encountered these before. And the great Inca was soon captured and his army dispersed in confusion because it was all centered around this one man. The move was made possible by the conquista technology of war, particularly horses, but it was the idea of this move which the Inca could not conceive of that proved decisive. And indeed, there are reports that the great Inca remained immobile on his litter as the Spanish began their attack because his role was so symbolic in the Inca armies. Of course, there was a degree of fortuity as well. The Inca themselves were weakened at that time in the aftermath of a plague of smallpox that had arrived in advance of the conquistadors, and that had caused in itself a succession crisis and civil war. Nevertheless, the reality was that it would take the Spanish 50 more years to subdue the Inca Empire, suffering setbacks and defeats along the way. It was a particular circumstance allied with technology and the ideology of conquest itself that enabled the Spanish to take over Peru and much of South America. A similar story, but one that highlights a significant different part of what I'm trying to get at here, can be told for the British conquest of India. The British had before their eyes subjugation of empires through the example of the Spanish and the Dutch. They had tried in the late 17th century to use military force against the Mughal rulers of India. They had been decisively quashed. This, incidentally, did not lead the Mughals to throw the East India Company, a privately backed company backed by the English and then British states, because they were confident in their military power and saw the foreign trading posts as beehives to be raided for money from time to time. And indeed, the East India Company paid its indemnities and was allowed to stay. According to Philip Mason, in his book A Matter of Honour, a history of the account of the Indian Army, its officers and men, military strategy was heavily dependent on cavalry. And this was based on a manual of Indian statecraft that was hundreds of years old. And this doctrine laid out that armies were built around a corps of elephants on which its leader rode, surrounded by highly skilled cavalry. And this caused problems commonly because should a general fall from his elephant, his forces would believe he'd been killed and would fall into disarray. So very similar to the attitude of the Inca as a band around a man to whom they owe loyalty. And of course, the man on the elephant made a great target for the very same reason. Doctrinally, spies and treachery were a staple part of warfare, and the expectation was that units would defeat. Generals were to try and use treachery first and foremost rather than open power. And this comes to the key point. Significantly, their military doctrine had no use for infantry, considering them to be, at most, baggage handlers. Most soldiers were hired by their commander, and they were not paid for much of their time. And apparently this was partly to try and stop them deserting. Technologically, though, they had muskets and cannon. Their swords were of very high quality. And this wasn't just imported goods. The Mughals had highly skilled craftspeople in their service. So William Dalrymple, in his book The Anarchy, describes how the British, when they arrived, gave a gift of a state coach to the Mughal, to which he responded by, in order to belittle it, by having his craftspeople reproduce it within days with improvements. So clearly there's no element of turning up and finding the primitives with less technology. Their technology was equal, if not greater than, at times, the British who eventually conquered them. Military status was closely tied to social status, and rank was determined by how many men someone was supposed to be able to provide for the army. It was reflected in the fact that although they had weapons such as cannon, they often were over-elaborate and were impressively big, but therefore immobile and impractical. This is not because they were stupid, but that their priority was symbolic status and impressing rivals and attracting followers. So their need to show off their power and wealth overcame the immediate practicality of being able to rapidly move and fire a cannon. Discipline was poor in their armies, and loyalty was not there. So soldiers were given a grace period to return if they deserted. And there was no permanence, and there was no continuity or loyalty. So what the British and their French rivals brought were European methods of military organisation, securing this loyalty of foot soldiers through regular pay and discipline. They organised around rock-solid infantry that could deliver a withering rate of musket fire, backed up by the bayonet. Apparently, Indian cavalry officers were unwilling to get too close lest they lose their precious horse. And it's a basic doctrine of military strategy that you don't send cavalry against infantry in closed formation. And the number of European troops in India were low. But the French and British began to train Indians in these tactics and skills and built highly successful mercenary armies that rivalrous local rulers began to hire in their disputes. Their warfare was of the massed cavalry horde, and cavalry cannot be sent in against infantry in close formation, as I've just said, repeating myself. Local rulers under the Mughals were highly independent, and indeed by simply establishing the trading post in Calcutta, or Calcutta as it is now, the British were expected, the East India Company were expected to run the courts and run society in general as if they were the local government. And warfare was almost constant. And the court of the Mughal itself was a mobile army camp. And indeed, in some ways, because of the role of the Mughals as a conquering force when they first arrived, warfare was almost meant to be continuous. That was the way that they justified themselves and the way that they made their money through winning battles. And this is a very potted history, but the ultimate victory of the British over the Mughals at the Battle of Plassey against the Nawab Siraj ud Daula, and they became the rulers of Bengal because they played the game of treachery and then applied their military doctrines to end the warfare basically. Clive secured the defection of Major Farr, but he had previously demonstrated a capacity for rapid manoeuvre and forced marches that had caught the much less manoeuvrable Mughal forces by surprise. His sepoys, Indians recruited into European armies, had shown great resilience and capacity to fight, even when being chased or besieged by greater forces. And in climactic conditions, if we're all feeling the humidity and the heat today, imagine running around in military kit and marching 20-odd kilometres and then fighting for the rest of the day, and which is what they did. So the British did possess small technological innovations. The ringed bayonet assisted turning musket men into pikemen. A screw on the cannon mount allowed for quick adjustment and elevation. But in both cases, it was discipline and the capacity to perform a withering rate of fire with weapons the Mughal forces were using less well that made the decisive difference. Just to reiterate, in this case, the technology of the British and Indian was not the difference, was not so great as between the Inca and the Spanish. But the political weakness of the Indians was similar. It was the application and way of thinking about war that proved decisive. The difference was ideology, not specific ideas, but the technology of how we think. Ideology is derived from the lived experience of people and takes the forms of expectation of, and ways of applications of ideas. It's fundamental premises. British military doctrine was developed through the rise of the foot soldier and the professional soldier, with no other status to gain but military victory. It was that lived experience that led to a different way of thinking. Where technology is based on looking and sounding impressive and inflicting on the glory of the ruler, there's a different approach to how it is used. In the modern world, firms have the expectation that their systems will be constantly interrogated and improved on, rather than looking for stability and durability. The question asked is not how will innovation make workers or customers happier, but how will it make more money? The way of thinking of modern technology is to innovate for profit. Aaron von Drees lived in it at a time when transport was being innovated, the world was being changed by ideas, and he thus sought his own invention. Indeed, he was an example of a new breed called the inventor, and he also produced an early type of typewriter, stenograph machine, and a type of meat grinder. He was drawing a stipend as a civil servant, without doing any work, which enabled him to pursue his ideas. But other people were inventing and gaining fortunes from patents incentivized him. Profiting from patents only became possible because of the Industrial Revolution, with its precision production techniques, and because the legal infrastructure was put in place to support being able to profit from ideas. And we can see the development of this legal infrastructure in the interesting case of the Boulton and Watt steam engine. James Watt improved on Thomas Newcomen's design for a steam engine with a more economical model that saved fuel, using a separate condenser if you're interested. He and Boulton tried to charge a fee for using their machine that amounted to the whole value of the fuel that would be saved. This diminished the incentive for mine owners to adopt their machine. The initial patent was registered in 1769, but had not been made commercially viable by 1775 when it would expire. So Boulton and Watt had to petition Parliament to extend it to 1800. It has been argued, and I have some sympathy with this, that their charging policy and assertion of their patent actually held back development of steam technology. Others argue that the patent made it possible to bring it to fruition. At this time, the system of patents was not fully developed, so Boulton and Watt's political acumen was the most important part of being able to derive their patent. Likewise, von Drees had to obtain ducal protection for his inventions. As a civil servant, he could not simply patent them. Patent law and political support for the generation of new ideas is part of the development of ideology of technology. that it's an intensely political and social fact, and it relies on human networks of influence and power to create and enforce those property rights that make it possible. When the workers take over the means of production for our own ends, we will inherit the technology, physical and intellectual, developed by capitalism. But our lives will not be shaped by that technology. We would continue to make history ourselves and would apply technology in ways which suit our social structure and our needs. That world doesn't exist yet, but when it does, we will develop the technology of a suitable ideology for making use of technology to serve the whole community, not just part of it. Patents, designs, and the like are forms of technology. They will be including the things we own in common in socialism. But these things are thought objects, as distinct from ways of thinking. And to be clear here, by ways of thinking, I'm not talking about algorithmic processes, which can in themselves be defined and patented, but the whole approach to the idea, including feelings. The conquistador and the East India Company men were driven by desire for glory, wealth, and loyalty to each other and their cause. They had expectations and implied premises that may never have consciously entered their minds that helped shape their response to events. I think I can make things a little clearer. Possibly not. We can look at a chess set. The pieces and board are tools by any strict definition. They are things we use to achieve a definite end, that is, to be applied to the board in order to play the game. Each piece contains and conveys distinct information about how it can be used, and the knowledge of how a bishop or a knight moves is a distinct piece of technology in its own right, existing as ideas only, as are the general precepts of strategy. A knight-shaped piece is useless to someone who does not know how a knight moves, and someone who does not know how a knight moves cannot play chess at all. That same person can learn openings, middle and end game strategies, combinations and sequences of moves, and the general principles of playing. It is at this point that we reach a type of technology I'm talking about. Thinking about the game, knowing different strategies, approaches to playing, and being able to think about their opposing players. Knowing not just how to use the tools, but to adapt them. And of course, at this level even, there are fashions that limit and structure it, but I won't bore you with a discussion of 20th century ultra-modern openings and kingside pawn fianchetto attacks. Bring these ideas back to a real-world example. I recently read a book called The Knowledge, How to Rebuild the World, in which the author, after an apocalypse, in which the author, Lewis Dartnell, writes about the basic things we need to know in such an eventuality, going from the basics of agriculture to the basic principles of internal combustion and how to vulcanize rubber. It's not a technical work and probably could not itself be used to bootstrap a new society, but it does outline the basic ideas of what is needed and point to some of the various sources of detailed information. Noticeably, it doesn't include money or finance as a key requirement for a new society. It does, however, point to scientific method of measurement and observation as the absolute key to restoring technological society. This is, of course, if post-apocalyptic people want to rebuild industrial society, in which case vulcanizing rubber and the scientific method are alike useless to them. The key aspect of technology, then, is the human mind, not just as technology, such as mathematical methods, natural facts, or architectural plans, but the human need and intention that is applied to these things. The post-apocalyptic world he imagines is different from any society in history, in which it might be using antiquated technology, it comes armed with considerable knowledge of how to apply it better and use it differently. Consider it a useful thought, by the way, thought experiment for socialists, inasmuch as it gets us to think about what is actually necessary in organisational terms for society to exist. It invites us to, in essence, plan an economy. That act of imagination isn't straightforward, nor easy. Socialism would have a different social infrastructure and set of aspirations from today, without patent protections and legal enforcements of profits, but would have different structures to enable people to develop and share ideas and profit from them as society benefits generally. At a guess, one of our incentives would be labour saving to produce more free time, which in turn may well turn into time to dream up new ways of saving time and new inventions. Another educated guess would be that people would learn from experience of using tools, both intellectual and physical, and instead of feeling disempowered by their position in a hierarchical organisation, will freely give voice to suggestions for change without managers, fearful of their own positions, vetoing them and trying to get them to go along with working to grade. That is, free human beings coming together without coercion for their mutual benefit will produce ideas suitable to those conditions of production. What I've tried to argue here is that the use of technology depends on the humans wielding it, and that includes ideational technology as well as physical. Human beings make history, not specific items of technology, and that it's social needs which spurs on technological innovation. When the writers in the Socialist Standard noted the Russian Revolution could not have created socialism, is this huge mass of people, they wrote, numbering about 160 million and spread over 8.5 million square miles, ready for socialism? Are the hunters of the north, the struggling peasant proprietors of the south, the agricultural whale slaves of the central provinces, and the industrial wage slaves of the towns convinced of the necessity and equipped with the knowledge requisite for the establishment of the social ownership of the means of life? Unless a mental revolution, and that's the key word I was including the quote for, such as the world has never seen before has taken place, or an economic change has occurred immensely more rapidly than human history has recorded, the answer is no. A useful step for all of us towards realizing socialism is to remind ourselves that technology is and should be the servant. Like an end of an episode of Scooby-Doo, the monster of technology should be unmasked and revealed to have been people all along. So that's why I've looked at the bike, why it wasn't invented thousands of years ago, how it wasn't the innate technological superiority alone that led to European conquest of the world, but the idea of the conquest and different approaches to war. And I've examined the way in which how we think differs. I've examined how the way we think differs from what we think and is a form of technology in itself. I've suggested that living in socialism will produce new ways of thinking, and that living in capitalism is producing the intellectual technology that will make that possible. Thank you very much.